So in Hindu religion, you have a lot of deities, but they are not God in our sense. I mean, they are an expression of Atma Brahma. So many other systems, they have deities, but they have also one supreme principle that is the generating principle of everything. And so according to Joseph Campbell, any deity that gets stuck with an archetype is worship of idols. So then the question was, when do people have the feeling they arrive? When do people have the feeling they're really in touch with the supreme principle, the universe? And I found those states fell into two categories, where people really felt they were at the cradle of everything. They either understood what it was about, they had all their questions answered, or they were in a state where there was no need to ask questions, which is the same as understand everything. If you don't have any more questions to ask, you have a sense of understanding, you have a sense of arriving, you have a sense of fulfillment. Now, one of these states was a state which can be called void. Some people, sophisticated people, talk about it as supracosmic and metacosmic void. Means it's emptiness that is supraordinated to everything and also in some sense underlies everything. You can find in Buddhist scriptures statements like form is emptiness and emptiness is form. So there's a state of mind that you can go into in a non-ordinary state of consciousness, which is a state of absolute metaphysical emptiness, nothingness. There's nothing there, yet it's conscious of itself. There's a point of consciousness that's aware of that emptiness. And there's paradoxically also the sense that there's nothing missing in that state. There's potential for all of existence, but none of it is concretized in any way. And you can link it to quantum physics. This is exactly what quantum physicists come to, talking about the dynamic void, talking about the probabilities, everything ultimately being just probabilities, but nothing is really manifested until it's observed and so on. So that is one state where you have the feeling you are. There is a sense of understanding where things come from. It's not understanding here, it's experiential understanding of the gut level. This is the source of existence. It comes from nothingness. Now this is tremendously important in understanding the psychology of Western cultures and in comparison, for example, to the Oriental cultures. We had a meeting in 85 in Kyoto, which was the International Transpersonal Association, and this was the time when there was tremendous conflict between Japan and the United States in business. You remember these difficulties? And they were having conferences trying to straighten it out. And there was a Jungian Japanese psychologist at the conference, Dr. Kawai, and he gave a talk on the differences between the Japanese mind and the Western mind in Jungian terms, in terms of the underlying archetypes, in terms of the underlying mythology. And he showed that the Oriental philosophy is a system with an empty center. Creation comes out of nothing. Creation comes out of emptiness. Our mythology, in the center is the power station. There is creative power. The creation comes out of the creative impulse. And then if you follow that, you get a totally different cosmology that has then reflection on the hierarchies in culture and so on. Whether you see the whole system as being self-supported, interconnected, or whether you see it as a system where you can have selective hierarchical control over things and so on, which is very much the Western psychology. So people who have powerful experiences of the void, they emerged basically with a new philosophy, which is different from Western, and they feel a tremendous resonance with things like the I Ching, which expresses this kind of philosophy, the Taoist type of thinking. Now, when you are in that state, you can also understand how something can come out of nothing, how creation can come out of emptiness. Again, this is something that is absolutely inconceivable for the left hemisphere thinking. You know, that we have a system in science where we believe everything is cause and effect. Only when you take it all the way back and you're in trouble. Because then you have the question, what was the first cause, what was before the first cause, if there was a first mover, who moved that mover, and so on. And you see the absurdity of the system. Of course, science doesn't deal with it, or didn't deal with it until quantum physics, until people like Hawking and so on talking about, again, creation out of nothing. If you read Hawking, Steve Hawking, he would say things like, nothingness has no other choice than to create existence. But you don't get very far with the cause and effect thinking, which we are dominated by in science and in our culture. That simply doesn't work. And we just draw a line there. We don't deal with that in science. And we play a game. We think we have it down. Everything is very reasonable. And we sort of ignore that big hole. It's like the Sufi story when a man goes and sees somebody under a lamp, sort of looking for something on the ground. He says, what are you looking for? He says, I'm looking for a key. He says, where did you lose it? He says, over there. He says, why are you looking for it here? He says, well, it's dark there. I wouldn't have a chance. So you have a very reasonable scientific system, only you don't deal with things where you wouldn't have a chance. Like, you don't ask questions. You just say, well, consciousness somehow comes out of matter, it comes from your brain. You don't ask the question, how does that happen? How can that kind of thing happen? Because you wouldn't have a chance. So you deal with those kinds of manifestations that make sense in your system. So you can talk about causes and effects, except when you go to the beginning. So that kind of thinking doesn't apply. We just will not deal with that stuff. So in the non-ordinary state, you get experiential sense how that can happen. You know, something comes out of nowhere. But you have to understand that you are also in a situation where you don't believe anymore that this is matter. This is solid stuff. This is solid Newtonian stuff. So you're not really on that level. You're not dealing with the question, where does matter come from? You are dealing with a question of consciousness technology. How is the experience of matter created? And that's a whole other ballgame. We might be able to do it electronically 10 years from now. I mean, you can fool yourself with a hologram. You can fool yourself optically. You can create form. You can, with holophonic sound, you can sort of synchronize it with acoustics. You can have a talking person, holographic person, and your only remaining sense is touch in this kind of holography. You go there, and if you go through, it's a hologram. If something tells you you can't go any further and you get a tactile sensation, it's a body there, it's a solid object. So, you know, 10, 20 years from now, we can have something like holography that's going to do something to our touch, what Aldous Huxley called the feelies. You go to the movies and, you know, you get a few electrodes and you will not just see and hear, but when they're making love, you also starts doing something to your pelvis, and at that point, there's no way of telling difference between technology of consciousness and reality. So anyway, when you go to the point of the void, you understand the creation, but not the creation of matter. You get the understanding of the creation of the illusion of the world. You get the kind of the Hollywood aspect of the divine play of Leela. How is that show created? What kind of technology goes into it? Now, the first more tangible expression of the void, the first stage of creation, then is a different state of mind. And again, it's very difficult to describe in words. People usually complain, not having words, not having language for it. But they will tell you something. And so when I studied those descriptions, when people talked about that state, it boiled down to basically three different things. One is, if you are in that state, you know that you exist. There is existence. There is consciousness, awareness, knowledge, and the state is blissful. There are no forms yet. You know, there are nothing specific, nothing tangible. It's just a state of being in which you know you are, you know you are conscious, and you know that you are experiencing your existence as being blissful. It's a state of overwhelming bliss. Now, if you go into Oriental scriptures, particularly into Sanskrit, you'll find the term for this. This is called Sat Chit Ananda. Sat means to exist or existence. Chit means sometimes translated as awareness, consciousness, and so on. And ananda is bliss. So this is the supreme principle. This is the creative principle. This is out of which all this seems to come. And if you are in that state, you are experiencing it, you know that it's you. I mean, you have become that principle, so at that point you don't see it as something outside of yourself. And this is the message from the Upanishad, Tattvam Asi, thou art that. Now, the way to think about it is that as you move through an altered state of consciousness, boundaries become illusory. I can become another person, I can become an elephant, I can become, you know, something 20 years ago, I can become the dancing Shiva. So, again, if you move out of our cognicentric state, where everything that you experience in non-ordinary state of consciousness doesn't count, you start questioning whether you are your body ego, because it's also based on your experience that you're a body. If you experience yourself in a very convinced way as not being a body or being another body, you know, that is an interesting piece of information. And once you start taking those states as significant, you start redefining who you are. And if you had a few transpersonal experiences all the way to the Satchinananda principle, you realize that your identity is not fixed. You are the body ego, that's certainly one interesting, relevant aspect of it, but you are also the Satchinananda principle, and you're also anything in between and around it. Because you can experience boundaries of various kinds. If you experience yourself as an elephant, you also have boundaries, but those are boundaries of an elephant. So there are all kinds of things in which you create boundaries within an infinite continuum, but they're all relative. You can move through it, you realize that they are not mandatory. They're not absolute states. So your true identity then, if you take the message from non-ordinary states, is you are the totality of cosmic energy, or totality of consciousness, and within that, at different times, on different levels, you can experience yourself locked within systems that have boundaries, but those boundaries are not absolute. They feel very real, they feel very absolute at the time when it's happening, but it's all negotiable. You are not really ultimately bound by any of them. So this is the idea, you know, we are all God, we are all the totality of cosmic energy, because none of us have boundaries. So it doesn't mean that, you know, I am the divine, you're not. That awareness has little to do with the body ego. It's like a pyramid where there are a lot of stones here, and then on each higher level there are less and less stones, until at the top there is just one entity then. And on that level, because we are also that, on that level we are all one. On this level, obviously, you know, the sense of separateness has some meaning. So this comes as this identification with Sat, Chit, Ananda, sort of infinite being, infinite awareness, knowledge, and infinite bliss. Then when people reach that state, then certain questions start emerging, particularly in those of us who are more inquisitive and curious than others. And that is, it's obvious to you that creation somehow comes from there. It's obvious that it's the cosmic furnace, the stuff that's throwing out the forms and creates the different levels of reality, different kinds of reality. Now the question comes, two questions. Why does that principle bother? You know, why does it create all those things? And the other one is, how does it do it? And again, a lot of people would come up with answers to those questions, and they're pretty similar. They are varieties, but they're pretty similar. So the question, why does it create? First of all, that question, why, in the way we experience it on this level, doesn't make that much sense there. What happens to you, you experience how that creation happened. You are that source, and then you experience the emergence out of form, out of that source, so you understand it on a gut level. You don't have an answer that would necessarily satisfy you on this level, but it's a state-bound answer which is experiential. Now, if some people try to describe it, they do something interesting, which I've seen earlier in many of the people who were labeled psychotic, And that is when they write something, it's going to be full of capital letters. You know, it's love, but it's not love. It's love with capital L. And it's loneliness, but it's not just ordinary loneliness. It's not the kind of loneliness that you can experience, but it's something to do with it. It's loneliness with a capital L. So some people would tell you that that source creates because of its incredible richness, because it's of its abundance. It's so overflowing with potential. It's so overflowing with creativity that it just has to give it out. On this level, the parallel would be an artist who has a lot of inspiration and would suffer tremendously if it just doesn't come out in some way. I mean, it simply has to do it. Another biological parallel would be a cell that will divide. At a certain point, you see there is churning and there are tensions, and then something starts happening, and before you know, there are two out of one. It comes out of inner tension that is an expression of that richness and creative potential and also creative need. The source does not have a choice. It has to do it. It is part of its basic nature to do that. So some people say it's the inner richness. There are people who will say also it's also a loneliness. As fantastic as this state is, there's just one consciousness, and there is something like craving for partnership, to share, to have something to relate. And the creation then comes out of that need to have something different from oneself. Other people say love. This has something to do with love. It's a gesture of love. Other people emphasize more the aspect of experiment, that there is tremendous curiosity. What is possible? What happens if? What happens if there is a universe where something that in its very principle is a spiritual entity will suddenly start believing that it is a limited body and has these sort of two hands, two legs. It needs this substance called oxygen, has to eat. What happens if there are going to be two of them in some kind of polarity, like male-female? What will happen if there is something like linear time and there is evolution, and at different times people will wear different costumes and so on? There is an experimentation happening. There's research happening. There is a exploration happening. There's an extreme statement which some people made, and which is actually the same as you find in the Kabbalah, which is the principle creates out of boredom. As beautiful as it is, it's monotonous, too much of the same, and there is a need for change. You find this, again, artistic expression of it in Wagner's Tannhäuser, when Tannhäuser, who was the troubadour, the minnesänger, ends up in Venusberg, which is the Venus Mountain. It's a mountain with a hollow inside, inhabited by nymphs and satyrs, and the most exquisite orgies happening, and the goddess of love. And he spent several years there, and then after this he starts craving trivia. You see, so wants to go back, and it wouldn't be bad to suffer a little. And then he finally sort of utters the name of Maria, and the mountain opens, and he's out back to the world, which is a mixed bag from this place where there is only rapture and ecstasy. And so that's creation out of boredom. Now then, the other question that people are asking is, how does it happen? What is the technology of consciousness? How are realities created out of consciousness? The answer that most people do give involves two principles that sort of cooperate with each other. One is it happens by the method of divisions. Something that is undivided, that is one, splits somehow and becomes many. The second process that goes hand in hand is something like partitioning, or some people say cosmic screen work. That means these split units of consciousness experience themselves as separate from each other and separate from the source from which they came. So somehow the element of self-deception and false sort of an illusion of separateness comes. A certain screen work, partitioning comes. Now you can't think about this as in terms of masonry. in technology of consciousness. This is more like forgetting. You see, that would be a much, much better metaphor. Alan Watts wrote a book, which is called A Book About the Taboo Against Knowing Who You Are. This is the idea of forgetting who we are, the partitioning, screen work, and so on. Well, we can say that through these two mechanisms, then these different levels of realities are created. One of them is the archetypal. There are sort of other kinds of worlds, universes. And one of these sort of holographic channels, if you want, in the world of consciousness, would be what we know as phenomenal reality. Ultimately, it would not be any more real or less real than the world of the Great Mother Goddess. In electronic technology, there are different channels. Sumerian underworld is channel 26, and you can spend some time there. You know, this is channel 3, and you can be there and you can believe that there is only channel 3 until somebody pushes the button and you switch to channel 6. But when we are here, we like to believe that this is the only one that is real and the others are some kind of derivatives of this one. Those other receptions are not real. But if you look into it, in deep non-ordinary states, you'll find out it's all created by the same technology. The fact that this looks, you know, more solid and so on, or more predictable, this is producer's trick in that understanding. Like if you have a movie and you have a producer that controls filmmaking, he can take you on any kind of trip. You see, it makes it sort of nice and solid and clear. And when you're looking at it, you say, now this is an episode of real life. And then you see the guy going to bed, and then the images sort of become black and white, and then it becomes a little blurred and sort of a little more fleeting. You say, you know, the hero's dreaming. And then you see somebody taking a pill, and then the colors become very vivid, and there's some kind of strange distortions, and you say, the guy's tripping. But on the Hollywood level, all it takes is one kind of technology. Those are tricks. You use different kind of experiential qualities for different experiences, and you can create different worlds, different nuances. So again, in something like Vipassana meditation, where you analyze perception, or in something like non-ordinary states, you can sort of see through it. It would be like up to this point, you were just watching the movie screen, and you thought all there was out there. And you couldn't figure it out. There were problems, like, you know, in some movies there were flying saucers, in other it was like Bambi, animals were talking, and you couldn't sort of get it quite together how it all is one reality. And one tremendous thing in Kashmir Shaivism would tell you, don't do that, that's waste of time. Stay in the ordinary state of consciousness and collecting information and trying to make sense out of it, because what you are experiencing is part of the story. This is the same thing that David Bohm is, who's a co-worker of Einstein's, is saying these days about science. Don't have the illusion that science is telling you anything about what the universe is like. Historical periods are art forms of the collective unconscious. So with Middle Ages comes medieval science, with 20th century comes 20th century science. They are not studying the same universe in different ways, more or less developed. This belongs, science and the forms of religion, belongs to the art form of a particular time. There's no way scientists can step out of the show, because whatever they are doing is part of the story on the screen. So in Kashmir Shaivism would be, as long as you want entertainment, you watch out there. If you are interested what it is about, this is not out there, you have to turn. And then you find out that there is some kind of source of light, there is some kind of celluloid, there's something is throwing pictures. Then you can ask, what is there a level behind it? And then you find out Hollywood, then you find somebody had a screenplay, somebody wanted you to have a certain kind of experience. And that is the explanation for why you are experiencing what you are experiencing. Things which are out there are not causally related at all. They wanted you to believe that they are causally related. If you see a Western and there is a cowboy shooting and an Indian falling off the horse, you make a connection in your head, say, the guy fell off the horse because the other guy shot him. Right? Wrong. the guy fell off the horse because they wanted you to believe that the guy was shot. And they also orchestrated some other kinds of things. They made a hole and something was dripping out of the hole. What is the reason why the guy fell off the horse? It's in the screenplay. It's because somebody was giving you an art form which involved a certain kind of experience, and it has to be nicely orchestrated, put together, so you can read into it causal connections. Now you can have states of mind when you will see that this is not any different. The reason why things happen in a certain way is because there is a certain higher order screenplay, and all the elements in what we are experiencing are governed by that. So whatever you are discovering in this level, you are part of the script. You are not stepping out of the script and making any kind of objective judgments about the script. I'm not saying this is so. Do you understand what I'm reporting? How people see the universe in non-ordinary states. And you can bring a good argument for this. I mean, it's in a sense, it's better than the one that we live with, because it covers much more information. It is a conceptualization for a much wider range of observations and experiences. And also it takes into consideration not just ordinary consciousness, but things that happen in other states of consciousness. Okay, now there is another question that people frequently ask, and that's a very interesting one, and that is, why is evil in the world? I mean, some of those experiences are experiences that we don't particularly like. And that's true for the non-ordinary states as much as it is true for our everyday life. There are things that we enjoy. There are other things that we could live without. There are other things that we really don't want as part of our life. So people ask very serious questions, you know, what is evil? Why is evil in the world? They ask this question Ramakrishna. Say, Swamiji, why is evil in the world? And he sort of thought about it for a while, and he said, to thicken the plot. Now, since we are talking about the movies, you imagine that we would take out of our world everything that we think shouldn't be there. Everything's bad, unpleasant, evil. So certainly we don't want to be sick. So let's take out diseases. Nobody has any kind of problem. We are all ideally healthy. And we do it with all of human history. Now you can't do this in an isolated fashion. You take out diseases. Now here goes the history of medicine. We don't have any heroes. We don't have any Virchows. We don't have any Pasteurs. We don't have the discovery, the exciting discovery of penicillin. Here goes Mother Teresa. There's no place for Mother Teresa. You don't have evil. You don't need church. You see, you do it a few times, take out a few things that we think shouldn't be there, you end up with a plot that is so flat that if somebody would make it to a movie, we wouldn't bother to go and watch it. I mean, think about the movies that fall in that category. They are not the movies that fill the movie theaters. So, you see, we want something, very deep essence in us wants all that whole range of experiences. You know, people go to movies where you explore just incredible dimensions of beings, which you wouldn't possibly dream about experiencing if they were real. The possibility to experience it is because you know it is as if. You can put yourself in a state where you're actually experiencing it, but you can also, if it gets too heavy, you can step back and say, what am I doing? This is just a movie. But you go there, you want it anyway. So this idea is that the cosmic artist, if you want, the creative consciousness, it will also tend to enact all kinds of possibilities. Now, in the concrete sense, then people ask the questions about evil, and they very frequently find out that in order to create out of itself, the cosmic principle has to negate itself. So the first step in the process of creation would be something like a negative mirror image of the Satchinananda. Now, if you think about it, what we consider bad, evil, painful, unpleasant, fits into three major categories, and each of them is a negation of one of the aspects of the creative principle. The first part of it is Sat, which is being, existence, infinite being. It's not one nice category of evil, bad things, which have to do with non-existence, not being, or limited existence. The fact that we don't live forever, we age, we die, we can lose our life. Those are things that have to do with negation of existence. The second one is Chit, which is awareness, knowledge. So that category is limited awareness or ignorance. And then the most obvious category is the negation of Ananda, of bliss, which would be the whole spectrum of pain, unpleasant, negative emotions, physical pain, difficult experiences, and so on. So we would have this negative image of the Satchinananda and the negation of it, and then in the overall cosmic scheme where you have partitioning and you have divisions, you will find out that what we call evil, what we call bad, is actually identical with the partitioning principle. It is the principle that makes us feel separate from each other and separate from the source, that keeps us in oblivion of who we really are. Our essence is we are spiritual beings that have infinite existence. And then a lot of what we call suffering, all of it actually, comes from the fact that we are not aware of that, we are not in touch with that reality. In other words, if we knew that this is not as real as we think it is, we would have a very different freedom in experiencing the whole range. If I really were convinced that death is not real, you know, that would make a tremendous difference in my life. If I really believe that death is like giving up your old Chevrolet and buy a new car or put on a different trench coat, you know, we would have a very different opinion about other things. There would be many things that we would be doing, other things we wouldn't be doing, and so on. So it comes from the belief that we have limited existence, that we are really body egos, we are subjected to all these laws, secular laws, is a source of a lot of suffering in life.